So today, in honor of Father's Day, we are going to begin a two-part series focused on some of the fathers of New Thought. And just to clarify before we get started, when we think about New Thought, in America at least, the organizations, the faiths that have sprung from New Thought are Christian Science, Religious Science, Divine Science. I did them in alphabetical order to be fair, okay? Divine Science, okay, let's start again. Christian Science, Divine Science, Religious Science, and Unity, all sprung from the New Thought. That's right. So our first New Thought father has been called the American Shakespeare. He's the author most frequently quoted in New Thought publications, and his writings really influenced Charles Fillmore. I think you'll see that when we begin to talk about him. Would anybody like to guess who it is? Who the first one I'm going to highlight is? I'll give you a little hint. One of Charles and Myrtle's sons was named after him. Does that help? Okay, well, I could have chosen many. There's really no, but that would be a good guess. She said E.B. Weeks, who's the one who had the effect on Myrtle so much. I chose to begin with Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson was born in 1803 in Boston. His father was a clergyman, as many of his male ancestors had been, and he attended the Boston Latin School, followed by Harvard University, and then Harvard School of Divinity. He was licensed as a minister in 1826 and ordained in the Unitarian Church, which is not a New Thought church, but that's where he was ordained in 1829. Emerson's early preaching focused on a personal nature of spirituality. And living in Concord, Massachusetts, he found kindred spirits in the group of writers and thinkers who lived there, including Margaret Fuller, Henry David Thoreau, Amos Bronson Alcott, who was the father of Louisa May Alcott, and many others. And in 1938, Emerson gave his famous Divinity School graduation address. In his book, Friends of High Places, Tracing the Family Tree of New Thought Christianity, Unity minister Tom Shepherd cites Earl Wilbur's summary of that revolutionary speech that Emerson gave that summer afternoon. And Wilbur says, Emerson complained that the prevailing religion of the day had little life or inspiration in it because it was forever looking backward in the past history of Christianity rather than listening to hear what God has to say to us today. And he urged all of those present, all of the ministers graduating and all the visitors, to seek the truths of religion within their own souls and to preach to all what God revealed to them there. That religion could no longer be so cold and formal, but it had to be a vital personal experience. And the rest of Emerson's message was, he insisted that every single human being become what Jesus Christ was. He denied that unique identity of Jesus, but saw him as a way-shower for all humanity to realize its oneness with God. Does that sound familiar to us today? You can see this influence on Charles Fillmore. He also wrote, Jesus Christ belonged to the true race of prophets. He saw with open eye the mystery of the soul. Drawn by its harmony, ravished with its beauty, Jesus lived in it and had his being there. Jesus also affirmed the greatness of humankind in an era where most people believed in original sin. He was true to what is in you and in me. He saw that God incarnates in all of us. He said, I am divine. Through me, God acts. Through me, God speaks. Would you see that you too are divine? Would you see the God, in his words, in thee, and we would say in ourselves? Well, that was pretty radical, as you can imagine, in the day. And at that point, the young divinity students and all the visiting ministers were on the edge of their seats, mesmerized by Emerson's words. And, would you believe, the entire School of Divinity walked out in silent protest. Every member of the School of Divinity. And Ralph Waldo Emerson was banned from Harvard University for over 30 years. Amazing. In an article written in 2012 in the Harvard Review, they finally made nice and honored him, but it was many years later. Colleen Walsh writes, "After Emerson addressed the Divinity School that day, religion was forever changed. Ralph Waldo Emerson argued for the notion the divine speaks within each one of us." So he's our first father. And our second father of New Thought was actually born 1 year before Emerson. He was born in 1803, but I include him second because he was among the first to bring the ideas of Emerson into practical application in the field of healing, which is an important component of New Thought. And if you're ever playing Jeopardy and the answer is the father of New Thought, the correct response would be, who is Phineas Parkhurst Quimby? Have anybody ever heard of him? I hadn't either until Randy taught me about him a few years ago. Unlike Emerson, Quimby was born into a family of modest means in Lebanon, New Hampshire, as one of seven children of the village blacksmith. When he was two, his family moved to Belfast, Maine, where Phineas spent the rest of his life. His education did not go beyond common school, sort of grade school for us, after which he was apprenticed to a clockmaker, and that became his trade. But despite his formal lack of education, Quimby was well known for his extraordinary, inquisitive, and inventive mind, and he actually did patent several inventions. Now, Quimby shares something with Myrtle Fillmore, and that is, in his early 30s, he was afflicted with tuberculosis, then called consumption. At the time, he was treated by a physician with calomel, and for the chemists in the room, and I know there's at least one, it was mercurous chloride, that's what it was. And he was treated in such massive doses that it poisoned his entire system. His teeth rotted and fell out. He became so weak that he had to give up his business and all hope of healing. And at that time, Quimby had a friend who had cured himself of tuberculosis by, of all things, going horseback riding, engaging in this activity. But Quimby was too weak to even sit on a horse, so he thought he might try carriage riding. And after his very first ride in a carriage, just going as fast as he could, he actually felt a little bit stronger. So he continued this course of action, and it produced remarkable results. Quimby actually then returned to work a year or so later and felt fine for many, many years. But it planted this seed into him about how healing was partly mental. And also, like Myrtle Fillmore, Quimby's life was changed when he attended a lecture in 1838. A Dr. Collier had come to town and spoke about a new demonstration then called mesmerism, now referred to as hypnosis. So Quimby began studying this and practicing it anytime he could find a willing participant. He actually later partnered with a young man named Lucius Berkmar. This is a picture of them here. Lucius had this ability to be easily hypnotized. He would fall into a trance immediately, and while in the trance, he was able to diagnose diseases. So together, they continued to practice healing all around the area, and again, Quimby saw the mental and placebo effect of mind over body. Because when Berkmeyer prescribed medicines with no physical value, patients again and again were healed. And so Quimby got the idea it was about consciousness. And through these experiments, he arrived at his theory of mental healing, which actually did become the real beginning of the New Thought movement in America. And for the record, Quimby later rejected hypnotism. He gave it up. But he never gave up on the power of suggestion to cure a disease. He believed that disease was the result of error thoughts, and healing resulted from thoughts of truth and alignment with a greater truth. He began his work as a healer in his home, and in 1859, his practice had grown to the point where he had to establish an office in Portland. Now called Dr. Quimby, he worked healing people until he passed in 1866. Phineas Quimby devoted his entire life to healing the sick, and records show that he worked with over 12,000 patients, among them Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science. And Phineas kept detailed notes about all his healings, and his discovery that healing could actually work even if the person being healed was at a distance, that healing worked with a power that transcended time and space. That was really the beginning, in a way, of and a factor, I guess I should say, that contributed to the idea of the healing ministry of Silent Unity, because they pray all the time with people who are not in the room. And at some point, Quimby began to see a real spiritual aspect to his work. Horatio Dresser writes, "It was a long road for Quimby to travel from where he first started out believing in medical doctors to then believing in mesmerism, and finally to develop a faith in an inner or higher self immediately open to the divine presence with its guiding wisdom quickening the mind of the Christ." Now, the more Quimby worked in healing and spirituality, the more he developed two pet peeves. Not necessarily in this order, they were doctors and priests. Quimby could not tolerate either one. He wrote, "These two groups are the foundation of more misery than all the other evils in society, for they have a strong hold on people. They conspire together to humbug people. And they have invented all sorts of stories based on fear and have kept people under their, the priests and doctors, powers." He did not mince words about his pet peeves. Quimby also wrote himself that Jesus' healings were possible because his wisdom was from a higher order, and he was able to transcend people's physical issues and spiritualize ideas and beliefs and draw on spiritual truths. And about himself, he said, "But as a physician, I give myself in perfect faith to the guidance of a higher wisdom than that of man." So you can see how Quimby's ideas really had an effect on Myrtle's healing and a lot of the healing that followed that. Now, our next father of new thought needs no introduction. Almost everybody in the room knows who he is. It is our co-founder, Charles S. Fillmore. Does anyone know what the S stands for? Any guesses? Well, I'm not surprised because he never, ever used it. He never used this name. He must not have liked it. It was actually Sherlock. Fillmore's middle name was Sherlock. And Fillmore was born on August 22nd, 1854, on an Indian reservation near St. Cloud, Minnesota. His father was actually a Chippewa trader in the day. As Jim Freeman writes in the story of Unity, I know several of you have read this, Charles Fillmore was born in a log cabin where the only protection against the 40 degree below zero cold of Minnesota winters was the huge fireplace that devoured logs faster than he and his younger brother could bring them in during the winter. And when Charles was 7, his father left home. The boys saw their father once in a while, but his mother was the main influence in his life. And Jim Freeman calls Charles' childhood a kind of Huckleberry Finn experience, because he and his brother Nathan used to wander in and out of the Indian lodges and teepees as freely as did the Chippewa children. On one event, however, when Charles was less than 2 years old, and he was alone with his mother in the cabin, a band of painted Sioux charged in, tore little Charles out of his mother's arms, and took him away. And they didn't return him until sunset. Where they had taken him, Charles never remembered, but he always had a feeling that they had used him in some sort of a mystical ceremony. So, who knows? Charles briefly attended a one-room school. He had very little education. His mother, Mary Georgiana Fillmore, as I said, was a really strong influence on him. With a great zest for life and very little fear, she single-handedly raised a family in the wilderness, and Mary earned money as a dressmaker to feed and clothe herself and her two sons. And she modeled for her sons always the tenacity of will to press forward no matter what. So Charles inherited that from his mother. In his youth, Charles had a skating accident that, in the words of Jim Freeman, were probably the determining incident of his life. Charles himself wrote, "I was bled, leached, lanced, seasoned, blistered, and roweled." He probably shared Quimby's opinion of doctors, because, you know, medical science was not very progressive in those days. And he said, all right, those of you with weak stomachs, close your ears. "Six running sores were artificially produced on my leg to draw out the disease condition that was presumed to be within." pretty disgusting. For 2 years, the condition plagued young Charles, causing great pain. And the little boy on his good days would be up on homemade crutches, hopping around the cabin, trying to help his mother. Freeman writes, the boy did not know what it meant to give up to sickness and discouragement. Probably the spirit of his mother helped him more than anything else, for she fired her son with courage, which, if it did not have the power to stop the infection in the leg, it did have the power to stop the infection from spreading to the little boy's spirit. When, after 2 years, the disease finally ran its course, it left Charles with a withered leg. But it left something else too, Freeman says, a spirit that was not daunted by pain, a vital, determined, courageous spirit. It was this robust spirit that was to shape the life of the man who became Charles Fillmore. And a short time after that, Charles went to work to help his mother. His first job was as a printer's devil in St. Cloud. There he learned some of the printing trade that he was to use 30 years later when he published Unity's first magazine, which was entitled Modern Thought. And after that, he worked in a grocery store and he worked in a bank. And about this time, Charles met someone who had a huge impact in his life. And no, not Myrtle yet, another woman. And her name was Caroline Taylor. She was the wife of an officer, a military officer who was stationed in St. Cloud. And Caroline had been to college, a rare event for women of the day. And she had a great love for classical literature. She took Charles on as a student along with her own son. Charles had a curious and quick mind, one ready for books and learning. Her own son wanted to be out playing baseball, but Charles couldn't do that, so he was really always an avid reader. And many nights after work, he would go to Mrs. Taylor's to study Shakespeare, Tennyson, Emerson, Lowell, and many others. He learned to love the beautiful language and compelling ideas, and all of his life, his own writings would be full of quotations from those literary giants. Those of you who've read Charles Fillmore know that to be true. He and Myrtle would become great admirers of the American Transcendentalist, and in fact named two of their sons after them, Lowell Page and Waldo Emerson. And not only did Mrs. Taylor teach Charles an appreciation for great literature, but she also taught him the rules of grammar and rhetoric, about which he knew nothing. And often they would pore over something that Charles had written, and she would gently point out his mistakes. And he grew immensely from that as a writer. Perhaps even more importantly, though, Mrs. Taylor was interested in the new ideas from Emerson and others that, seeping out of New England, were challenging the dogma of Orthodox theology, and she helped stimulate an interest in those ideas in Charles. Now, when Charles was 19, he went down to the railroad station in St. Cloud and bought a one-way ticket to begin his journey to Denison, Texas. He had a cousin there, and he thought it would be a great adventure. There, he began working right away at the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, and he soon became chief clerk. As soon as he was able, he sent for his mother. He always had a lifetime love and appreciation for what his mother had done for the family. In Denison, Charles attached himself to a group of American pioneers with refinement and education who gathered to discuss literary and philosophical ideas. And in this group, in 1876, he met a red-haired schoolteacher from Clinton, Missouri, named Myrtle Page. And he fell in love with her immediately, and he and Myrtle were finally married in the spring of 1881 in Clinton and immediately set out together for Pueblo, Colorado. Charles had exactly 10 cents in his pocket when they arrived, when they got off the train, and there he went into real estate, and within just a year or so, his business prospered, and they were doing very, very well. It was also in Colorado that the Fillmores' two sons, Lowell Page and Waldo Rickard, were born. And Charles wrote, "But I never ever seemed satisfied with my surroundings or at peace with my work, and the urge to go elsewhere was always with me," had that wanderlust spirit. "Then I had a strange dream. An unseen voice said to me, 'Follow me.' I was led up and down the hilly streets of Kansas City," which looked familiar, although I'd never even been there. "And the presence stopped and said, 'You have work to do here.' Know that the invisible power that has located you will continue to be with you and aid you in your appointed work. And so then, after a very brief stop in Omaha, Nebraska, the young family headed for Kansas City, and there they would remain for the rest of their lives. And there also, Fillmore's third child, Royal, was born. Now, Charles describes himself at age 35 as a chronic invalid, seldom free from pain, back to that skating incident. He observed Myrtle's prayer practice that led to her healing from tuberculosis, which I'm sure many of you in the room know, and eventually he became inspired by what he called her continued demonstrations of healing. Yet his spiritual path differed greatly from Myrtle's. He wrote, "I was much interested in the all the spiritual teachings of the day from different schools." And we know that he actually even studied Eastern faith, that was one of the things he studied. "For a time, I was mentally disturbed," he says, "by the many conflicting statements of truth by all these teachers. I noticed, however, that all the teachers and writers talked about the omnipresent, omnipotent God who is spirit and accessible to everyone." And then here's what's on the slide. "I said to myself, in all this babble, I will go straight to headquarters. If I am spirit and this God they talk about so much is spirit, then we can somehow communicate or the whole thing is a fraud." And then he continues, "I commenced sitting in the silence every night and tried to get in touch with God. There was no enthusiasm about it, no soul desire, but only a cold, calculating business method. I was there on time every single night, and I tried all sorts of ways to realize that my mind was in touch with the Supreme Mind. In this cold, intellectual approach, one can easily understand that I did not seem to get any conscious results. But I stayed with it month after month, mentally affirming words that others told me would open the way. And after that, Charles began having these exceedingly realistic dreams, which he finally realized were his guidance from spirit. His chronic pain ceased, his hip healed, and his leg lengthened. He wrote, in a few years, I dispensed with the steel extension I had worn since childhood. And sitting in the silence became a daily part of his regimen for the rest of his life." His granddaughter, Rosemary, I've read, would bring her friends into her grandparents' house, and Charles would be sitting in his chair in front of the fireplace, and she'd say, "Oh, don't mind my grandpa, he's just sitting in the silence." You know, and he did it for the rest of his life. Jib Freeman writes, "Charles Fillmore was born with an instinctive urge to seek out the meaning of life, and he was the kind of person that had to find that meaning in his own soul. Charles Fillmore, we might say, was an advocate of the open, inquiring mind, and all his life he took pride in being abreast of the latest scientific and philosophical discoveries and theories. And he famously said, I always reserve the right to change my mind." Wouldn't you wonder what Charles Fillmore would be writing and saying today? I bet some things would be different, although I think the core truths would be the same. And shortly before his death, at age 93, and this is in his own handwriting, Charles wrote, "I fairly sizzle with zeal and enthusiasm, and I spring forth with a mighty faith to do all the things that ought to be done by me." So Charles Fillmore, known as the American mystic, together with Myrtle, and building on all the other fathers and mothers of New Thought, founded the Unity Faith based on practical Christianity, and he became a force for unity and love throughout the world. Next week, we're going to look at some more modern fathers of New Thought. But today, as we just prepare for our prayer and meditation, let us affirm what Charles knew so well, the nature of our God, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God the good, omnipotent, and so it is.